This idea of advanced beings who lived among us in the past and interbred or hybridized with us in the deep past, that's a truly global story. It's there in the Bible, in the Book of Enoch, in African story. It's there in Norse story, in Celtic story. It's such an unlikely story, and yet it does repeat from culture to culture.
We have 1 billion Hindus in India. There is a huge part of those 1 billion who believe that the Nagas were there during ancient times. They coexisted with humans. They were a part of the humans. They used to interbreed with humans. There are also lots of people who believe that the Nagas still exist today. They are the guardians of the underground. They're guarding huge loads of treasure. Gold and silver and gemstones. It appears like a sci-fi movie. They're known for guarding the treasure, but they come to the surface if needed. You know, this is also found in carvings. This is found in the ancient carvings of Mahabalipuram, where the Nagas are seen as snakes under the ground, and they're slowly shape-shifting into humans when they come above the ground. Just a decade ago, they found an underground vault in an ancient temple called the Padmanabhaswamy Temple. This is guarded by the Naga doors. These are underground vaults guarded by Naga doors. One of the vaults, known as the Vault B, is yet to be opened because they think that there's going to be the greatest treasure inside it, and there's like a legal battle between two parties. So they don't want to open the last Naga vault. But they found.
Before we get into today's content, on behalf of the Fifth Kind TV, I want to say a big thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring today's content. Surfshark is a VPN that allows us all to become citizens of the world through online access. If you're like me, you'll enjoy watching online content from countries all around the world. But I live in Australia. And what I'm shown in internet searches will be different to what you're shown in Canada, America, the Philippines, Germany, the Netherlands, or wherever you're watching from. By using Surfshark, I'm able to access a world of online content and see all the things that you see and many other things beside. Surfshark enables us to become citizens of the world through online availability.
Get fully protected. Go to surfshark.com/fifthkind and get 4 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content.
People with an interest in ancient civilizations have been talking for a long time about the megalithic structures, technology, and symbology of ancient Egypt, Peru, and Angkor Wat. But what about Thailand? Is Thailand a missing gem in our search for knowledge of humanity's deep past? In November 2026, Praveen Mohan and I will be taking a select group on tour with us to explore these things in situ, as we tour the magical temples of Thailand. Here today to explore the mysteries of Thailand's temples and more besides is the beloved and world-renowned researcher, Praveen Mohan. Praveen, welcome back to The Fifth Kind.
Thank you for having me, Paul, and a big hi to all your viewers.
It's a great pleasure to have you with us once again. And this year, I'm really looking forward to the two of us being on the same continent and in the same places and exploring the same carvings and comparing notes in real time with others who are going to be fascinated in these topics. So I'm going to jump straight in to one of the temples that you and I are going to be visiting. This is the Phimai Temple Complex. And among the carvings we're going to be exploring there are carvings that suggest unfamiliar creatures. So I thought we'd start in an unfamiliar place, and I'll ask you how you interpret the
stories told by the carvings, how do they relate to a wider narrative tradition? And what are these strange creatures?
Okay, so you're asking me a very deep, complex question there. So if you go to the Phimai Temple in Thailand, now, first of all, a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of your viewers might have gone to Thailand, but for different reasons, right? For debauchery, for clubbing, it's like it has the nicest beaches in the world. But Thailand has kind of a hidden angle to it. It has a bunch of very ancient temples hidden everywhere, right? So one of the temples that really interests me is the Phimai Temple. The original name of this temple is Vimaya, meaning that if you go to the temple, it clears your illusions. The word Maya in Sanskrit means illusions. You know, you have kind of a veil of illusions over your eyes all the time, right? We wear a certain type of goggles to see what's there. We always look at it with some type of a lens. And this is why we're not able to see the reality clearly. But this temple is named Phimai or Vimaya, meaning that if you go there, the veil of illusions will clear up. And this is what we see when we take people there. You know, we had a few people cry in the temples because it just has that kind of energy. The temple has multiple strange animal-like carvings, not just one or two. I can probably talk about a dozen different carvings. One of them is the Naga. The Phimai Temple has a giant Naga bridge, which is the Naga is basically a reptile humanoid-like creature. The Naga is not a snake, but it looks like a snake, but it often appears with a human-like body. If you look at ancient Hindu texts, the Nagas appear often, and they're capable of shape-shifting into whatever they want. It's pretty much like the reptilian ideas today. And they live underground, which also matches with this, you know, the reptile beings that, you know, people talk about today. So when we talk about the Naga bridge, there's like a giant bridge that connects the ground level and the main temple. And most people think the Naga bridge only appears in the Angkor Wat temple in Cambodia, but the Phimai temple in Thailand has a great Naga bridge, and it has these like five-headed and seven-headed Nagas on all four directions. So if you go closer to these reptile-like beings, on their faces, on their necks, you will see a cymatic pattern, like a round pattern, okay? Now, what we think is, today, if we make a sound, we can visually represent it. Now, there are a variety of instruments used for this, like the Chladni plate. So if you have a plate, you just take a plate, and if you just pour lots of salt grains on it, and then if you just use a bow for the violin and you make a particular note, you will find a circular pattern. Now, what's really intriguing is that pattern almost matches with the pattern we see in this ancient temple. And each Naga has a different pattern. So it appears as though they're giving us some kind of a secret audio code. Right now, our technology, we are only, like, I'm able to make a sound and see it visually. This is our technology, but we should be able to reverse engineer that and see, go and study those cymatic patterns and reverse engineer the sound. And we might understand, now we don't know if it's some kind of a mantra, if it's some kind of a code, if there are words hidden in them. And you can see all these details in these Naga carvings. Okay, so this is one quote-unquote mythical creature, right? Because mainstream archaeologists and historians are like, no, the Nagas are mythical creatures. But they appear again and again, not just in India. They appear in Thailand. They appear in Cambodia. If you go to Sri Lanka, they appear. They not only appear in Hinduism, They also appear in Buddhism. If you, if not only is Vishnu like reclining on top of a Naga and the Naga is protecting him, even the Buddha is sitting under a Naga and the Naga is shown towering over him, showing, you know, its position there. And the third religion is also Jainism in India. There's like less than 1% of people following Jainism now. But once upon a time, it used to be a flourishing religion in India. But again, all the Jain, you know, messengers of God, they also had Nagas protecting them. So you can see that the Nagas were very prominent all over in the Indian subcontinent and Southeast Asia, right? But they're not actually limited to the Indian subcontinent and Southeast Asia, right? Because they're known as Nakash. If you go to the Middle East, they're actually called Nakash. And then if you go to Egypt, it's called Nebkal. They have these serpent gods, and they're called Nebkal. So you can see Nebkal, Nakash, Naga. So unless it's like, it's kind of the strangest coincidence in the world, right? Yes, exactly. you don't have that kind of similarity in iconography as well as, you know, the linguistic match.
And in the name, I mean, Nakash and Nagas is the same word. And we do find carvings and statuettes of these beings who seem reptilian but humanoid in form at the same time. We've got the same ambiguity in the Hebrew story of Genesis, where there's the serpent, the dragon, but somehow he's not a serpent because he's got limbs and can speak. So the same kind of mythical creature is there. And it always raises a question mark when I hear the language of mythical creatures around, say, the Naga stories. I mean, many years ago, if we were to approach the Mesoamerican stories of feathered serpents, we'd immediately say, well, this must be pure fiction, pure fable, because there's no such thing as something that is reptilian and feathered. And then in 1861, we discovered Archaeopteryx, which was a feathered reptilian. Now in the 21st century, everything from a velociraptor to a T-Rex was believed to have been feathered. So we've gone from thinking there's no such thing as a feathered reptilian to realizing, no, this was the dominant species on the planet for millions of years. That's how wrong we can be when we make assumptions about creatures being referred to in the past. But there is a whole narrative tradition around the Nagas in Hinduism. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how these beings have been interpreted in text form?
Sure, yeah. The Nagas are perhaps the oldest living beings mentioned in ancient Hindu texts. Okay, for the simple fact that the Nagas appear in all the texts, no text is exempt from the Nagas. They appear in Ramayana, they appear in Mahabharata, the two ancient epics of India. In Mahabharata, the Nagas play a major part. They are clearly described there. The Nagas always live underground, and they only come above the ground if needed, if they have a purpose. They are the guardians of the underground, and they're guarding huge loads of treasure, and they're guarding like gold and silver and gemstones. And it appears like a sci-fi movie to people, but just a decade ago, they found an underground vault in an ancient temple called the Padmanabhaswamy Temple, okay? And this is guarded by the Naga doors. These are underground vaults guarded by Naga doors. And one of the vaults known as the Vault B is yet to be opened because they think that there's going to be the greatest treasure inside it, and there's like a legal battle, you know, between, you know, two parties. So they don't want to open the last Naga vault, but they found at least $20 billion. Some people even estimate this to be like $50 billion with a B, dollars, amount of gold and diamonds and all sorts of treasure hidden in this temple. So it appears as though, so when I say the Nagas are guarding, you know, the underground, and they're the guardians of all, you know, the treasure, it just appears like a fantasy story. But what happens in India is that, like, the fact kind of fades, the fiction fades into fact here, okay? Because we can literally see this happening all the time. When they found these underground vaults, these are guarded by Naga doors, and they're inside these vaults, they're still finding billions of dollars worth treasure. Okay, so the Nagas are shown living underground. They're the guardians of the underground. They live in Patala. They live in Nagaloka, and they're known for guarding the treasure, but they come to the surface if needed. And this is also found in carvings. This is found in the ancient carvings of Mahabalipuram, where the Nagas are seen as snakes under the ground, and they're slowly shape-shifting into humans when they come about the ground. It's very interesting. It matches with today's reptilian ideas, because you can literally see the snake being a snake when it's under the ground, and then it slowly transforms. It starts growing like a human head and a human body when it comes about the ground. Okay, so these are shown as shape-shifting reptile beings, and these Nagas are capable of shape-shifting and taking any kind of shape they want.
Ancient Hindus reading or hearing these stories, would they regard this as pure story, as pure myth? Or was there a belief that in the deep past, we actually encountered shape-shifting entities?
This is a very good question, Paul. I mean, I can't speak for all Indians and all Hindus, but we have 1 billion Hindus in India, right? And there is a huge part of those 1 billion who believe that the Nagas were there during ancient times. They coexisted with humans. They were a part of the humans. They used to interbreed with humans. But there are also lots of people who believe that the Nagas still exist today. These Nagas are kind of the living deities. We're doing another India tour in September, if you want to come. And when we go there, you will see, like, there are more Naga statues than other gods. And you will see all the people, if the women don't have children, they go to the Nagas and worship them. The Nagas are considered the symbol of fertility. They offer milk to the snakes. You'll find these ant hills or termite hills, okay? And the cobras. India is famous for cobras. So the cobras go and stay in these termite hills, and people don't bother the snakes because they consider the Nagas as kind of the living deities. Right, but they don't consider them as like a full-blown gods. They consider them as kind of these underground deities that have always existed, and they're also guarding these treasures even today.
Yes, this idea of advanced beings who lived among us in the past and interbred or hybridized with us in the deep past, that's a truly global story. It's something I've written about in a number of my Eden books. It's there in the Bible, in Genesis 6, in the book of Enoch. It's there in African story. The land of my fathers on my father's side is Ghana, and there's a story of ancient non-human company hybridization there. It's there in Norse story, in Celtic story. I find it interesting that it's such an unlikely story, and yet it does repeat from culture to culture. So that really catches my interest. And something else you said earlier that caught my attention was the effect on people when they go to Femi Temple. I've been to other places on tour where there are particular sacred sites where we encourage people to prepare themselves before they go there to be calm, to be centered, to be attentive, to have their mind in the present moment. And very often they're very moved by they don't know what as they go into the sacred site. And it sounds like Phimai Temple is one of those places, a live temple, if you like.
Correct. What really happens, and we see this again and again when we go to ancient temples of Thailand, ancient temples of Cambodia, when we take people to Indian temples as well, what happens is that there is a certain type of energy or vibration to these ancient temples. It's very underrated. Today, people would just call this pseudoscience if we say there's a particular type of energy to a temple. But if you go to a concert, you automatically go to another vibe just simply because of the music. And even if you're deaf, I'm assuming you'll get into a particular synchronized vibe because everybody else is dancing. So you automatically have to match that vibration. Now, same thing happens with these temples, especially at the Phimai Temple. Now, when people go there, so there's like a giant temple, so you slowly increase the elevation. You go from the ground level, you take the Naga Bridge, and by the time you reach the main chamber, you've reached a little bit of elevation, right? But it happens kind of, you don't even think about it. By the time we go there, in the center, there's like a giant Buddha statue, and inside the main chamber, we are allowed to meditate or sit calmly, whatever you want. And then what happens is that you start absorbing the energy of that chamber, right? And whether you chant or not, some people definitely start crying because it touches your soul. And then this is what we see at multiple places when we go to these ancient temples, it kind of touches your soul. It has some type of energy to it, right? Whether you believe in deities, whether you believe in gods, or just a simple fact that before you, millions of people have come there and they've put their energy in that chamber, right? So millions of people would have come there and they would have paid their respect. So it has that energy to it. So it's very, when we go there as researchers, because we study each and every carving, and that's what I like to do. But as I take more and more people for tours, I notice that there's not one person who did not cry in our last tour, you know, when they go to ancient temples. So it must be doing something to them. It must have some type of energy inside these temples.
November 15th to 22nd, if I remember that right, that's your opportunity, you who are watching right now, to come and share this experience with us. It's something I'm really looking forward to sharing with you, Praveen, later in the year, and with a select group of people. The temple, the Phimai Temple, is it a temple that has the protocol of walking barefoot because it's still understood to be a live temple, or is it different to that?
Only inside the main chamber. You'd be okay wearing shoes and walking around. Most of the temples in Thailand today, they're just considered archaeological sites. And these are all hidden temples.
Okay? Yes.
So what's happening is that Thailand is a majority Buddhist population now, right? But they have all these ancient hidden Hindu and hidden Buddhist temples, which they don't go to these ancient sites anymore.
Yes.
Okay. Today, yeah, it's like going to an old, very old, like Rosslyn Chapel, you know, people just go there for like, you know, just because they want to see. They don't go there for praying. So these places, ancient places, are actually not visited by many people.
Yes. These are places that are being rediscovered by the world. This is what I find so beautiful and mysterious about the Thailand experience. This is, I think, what's so special about Third Eye Tours, that Thailand is a forgotten gem with regard to ancient knowledge, ancient civilization knowledge, and we're going back to something that's been there a long time, but that's been forgotten. It's now enjoying a time of remembrance, and it's really exciting to be a part of that. There's another temple you and I will be going to on the tour, which is the Phnom Rong Temple. Oh. And what I'm looking forward to seeing there, and I've seen you talk about this many times before, is depictions of what, to you and me, look like technology. And I'm talking about tablets and smartphones. So tell us a little bit about
that. Oh, yeah. I forgot that. I almost forgot about that carving. That's a very interesting carving there. When we went to the Phnom Rong Temple, I've done two tours, last year. And then this is going to be our third tour. I'm excited to have you and have, your followers come and see what they make of it. But I didn't even notice it because it's a giant temple. The Phnom Rong Temple actually is on top of a mountain. It's an ancient temple. Mainstream archaeological account, 900 to 1,100 years old. Could be much more ancient than that. It's on top of a mountain and it stretches for acres, okay? So I didn't even notice this carving, but when I was taking a bunch of people, I think it was October last year, so one person said, look, this guy is holding a cell phone and talking to somebody. And there's another person like right next to him, and he's doing the same, pretty much like what we're doing right now, right? So pretty much like how we're holding the phones and talking to somebody on WhatsApp. And you can see the exact same depiction. Okay, not once, twice in the Phnom Rong Temple. Now, we don't, and you can see that person smiling. You can see that, that yes. Person is kind of smiling. So as though he's interacting.
Yeah.
Correct. Which is, I posted it because it's very intriguing. Now, who knows, right? I would really like to think that this kind of technology existed during ancient times, and we see these type of carvings again and again in India, but that's the only time I found it, this kind of like almost smartphone, Wi-Fi, computer technology in Thailand. This is the only place. So when we go there, we'll definitely take a look at it.
Well, this is the great thing about going with groups of people and going with different people to these sites. Someone else will discover something that's not been found before. Last year, I was in Turkey in the Van province. I went for the third time to an archaeological site, and one of our tour group made a discovery that had not been made before, despite the fact there had been excavations there since the 1960s. This is an experience that people can have when they come on tour. They may notice something that has genuinely not been spotted before. But when it comes to these depictions of what look like smartphones or tablets in other places, what has been the mainstream archaeological explanation of what these things mean?
Well, the mainstream, if you're an archaeologist, right, especially if you're a government archaeologist who works in the archaeology department, you will not be able to come out and say, well, this guy's holding a smartphone. Now, we're only doing it because we're independent. We're not backed by any government. Nobody's paying us to do this, right? So we're not bound by any of these things. But if a government archaeologist in India comes out and says these guys are holding smartphones, he'd be out of his job, right? So this is just the reality of the situation. So they have to kind of dance around the subject, right? So they're going to say, oh, no, this guy's holding a mirror, right? Or they're going to say that this guy's holding a clay tablet. And we see this again and again. And if you go to an ancient temple called Rani Ki Vav in India, it's very interesting. If you ever get a chance to come to India, go to this ancient temple called Rani Ki Vav, because it's kind of an underground temple that's built in an inverted fashion. Okay, so normally the temples would look like this, but Rani Ki Vav temples look like is built like this underground. Okay, Now, if you go in there, you will not see one or two, but you'll see half a dozen carvings of various people holding like their phones like this, talking like this, all sorts of very, very similar like electronic smartphone devices. Okay. Now, of course, archaeologists and historians have claimed various things, right? So they're saying that no, this clay tablets, right? This is a woman looking at a mirror, right? So they have to come and dismiss it one way or the other because they can't really come out and say that. But if you go to ancient Indian texts, okay, if you go to ancient Indian texts, they talk about this technology all the time. They were even making movies in 1950s, like the black and white movies, where they would open a box and they would talk to another person who lived like many, many miles away, just like what we're doing right now. But you're sitting in Australia, I'm sitting in India, and I've opened a box and I'm talking to you, right? And this technology did not even exist 75 years ago. But there was a movie made in 1950 or 1960. It's called Maya Bazaar, I think. In that movie, the ancient people are shown opening a box and they're talking to somebody who lived miles, miles away. Okay. And this is mentioned in ancient texts. They always talk about how they were just able to talk to anybody they wanted, you know, remotely.
So this is something I wanted to ask you about today, because it seems that in Eastern traditions and in the Vedic traditions of Hinduism, the ancient scribes didn't have any embarrassment about talking about technological ideas or technological phenomena and being quite clear that's what they were describing. So a technology for remote communication, a technology for flying, technology for mass destruction, all this sort of thing. Whereas in other traditions, and the tradition I know best is the biblical tradition, the scribes and translators have blurred what the original texts are talking about. And so they've sought to find spiritual language to describe something that in the original Hebrew, for instance, really does sound like technology. There's been this. And it's not just been they haven't understood that technology has been described. There's almost a cover-up of moments in the Bible where technology appears. And one could talk about Ezekiel, one could talk about Exodus, you could talk about the Ark of the Covenant, the Urim and the Thummim, many other devices besides the Kavod, the Ruach, that people can fly inside. Why is it that there's been this embarrassment in the Judeo-Christian tradition with regard to ancient tech, but then when we get to the Mahabharata, to the Vedic traditions, there's no embarrassment. It's just told straight.
Correct. But the big difference would be that there's a lot more atheism, quote unquote. There's this belief that there's absolutely nothing outside of this materialistic existence. This is much more common outside of India in countries that practice very ancient religions like Hinduism, Buddhism. These kind of religions are much more open to this idea that there are non-materialistic, intangible entities. We're just more accepting of this. Right. And we have no problems in accepting that this kind of technology happened a long time ago. We do not. It comes as a part of the religion. Right. So even today's Christianity is a very watered down. If you come out and if you say, I believe that, you know, what's mentioned in Ezekiel, like some kind of a craft came, people view you differently because the society itself, you have a bunch of atheists and you have watered down, you know, Christians, I would say. Not people who believe everything. I mean, that's kind of a weird thing to say. I mean, I'm just hoping not to offend anyone. But in India too, it's the same thing. You know, not everybody thinks that this is what happened, right? But there are more people who are accepting of this idea that I'm not just sitting in a room theorizing it, right? I'm going to a remote temple. I'm literally pointing to the carving that looks like this technology. And then, yes, like we have physical evidence of an ancient carving that's thousands of years old or 900 years old or whatever. And I'm physically going there and showing that carving and telling you, you know, that that guy's holding this. There's a person, that person is smiling, looking at it. So there must be something going on. There's another carving like this. And this temple was built 900 years ago, even by mainstream accounts. And then I'm going to ancient Indian texts and trying to match what was mentioned in ancient texts thousands of years ago. So I'm just trying to put everything together to give you an accurate match of what this carving would be. And yes, ancient Indian texts do talk about this kind of very advanced technology, okay? But even though we do this, and this is what I really like to do, I like to go to ancient temples and find new carvings and find new, you know, details about architecture. Even so, there's going to be dissenters. There's not everybody would accept that, you know, this, you know, this as a fact or even as a real finding, right? It's very easy to dismiss it simply because it doesn't match, you know, your mental models. But yes, we have more people accepting it here. We have more people accepting it here in India, in Thailand, in Cambodia. The Eastern religions are much more about going inside of you, right? The Eastern religions are much more about going inside of you and finding your inner peace rather than having like a social acceptance. It's weighed less about your religion. You know, you can have your own deity. You can, like, we have so many deities. You can worship your own deity and nobody will ask you. And you can do your own meditation technique. You can have your own, yes, ideas, right? So it's much more acceptable here.
In the Atrahasis epic, our ancestors told a story about us being shaped as a workforce. Now, that's not metaphorical. That's not a fringe idea. It is written into one of the oldest narratives known to humanity. Now, if you'd like to explore the Atrahasis story in its own words, I've created a course that does exactly that at Ancient Knowledge Academy. In this deep dive, we walk through portions of the text line by line, comparing it with Genesis and other ancestral stories. We make a similar journey through the Bible and a similar journey through the works of Plato. And our journey widens to explore deeper questions about human origins and human consciousness. At the Academy, we find ways of bringing ancient and ancestral story to bear on our own worldview. If you're on a journey of reframing faith or old beliefs or reframing your worldview to get a deeper understanding of who we really are, what our history tells us as a human species, what our potential is, then you will enjoy the topics we explore at Ancient Knowledge Academy. We look at ancient civilizations and ancient texts. We consider lost time and study how belief systems can shape perception. Without panic, without dogma, and with an open mind to continue in our journey of exploration. And if you'd like to stand in the landscape where so many of these origin stories converge, the lands around Lake Van, the lands of modern Turkey and ancient Armenia, the place many traditions point to as the reboot of civilization, I take a group there every year, because standing in the place itself is very different to reading a story. If you'd like to join me in the Van province, go to ancientknowledgetours.com. And if you'd like to continue a journey with an online learning community, come to ancientknowledgeacademy.com. Wherever you are in your journey, whether you're just curious or if you're redefining how you understand humanity, you are very welcome to
to continue your exploration with me.